is the 17th. For those of you of Irish or Catholic or green-loving extraction, I wish you a happy St. Patrick's Day. For the rest of you, perhaps we can figure out someday why it is that in New York one can get green bagels, but only today. What we're going to talk about now, today, and perhaps it's, you might see it as out of order, but as a follow-up to last week's exercise, with which I was generally very pleased, now we're going to really start looking at how license agreements are structured and what the provisions look like. Now, as a starting point, of course, they're contracts. And contracts have certain parts to them. All agreements. Remember, we talked, I think, about the who, what, where, why, when, and how, I believe, we looked at with license agreements generally. And that remains true. But you will also see that within a type of contract, you generally see similar structures. Not always, but generally. Similar kinds of provisions, similar layouts. Generally speaking, contracts will start with a listing of the parties and the general what it's all about. Thank you. Once you've done that, though, the next step is going to be really think about it from most relevance, most importance, to least importance. But keeping in mind that every piece of an agreement needs to be correct, needs to be enforceable. Even something called miscellaneous can often be the key part of litigation, the key thing that will make your client win or lose. I'm just trying to try to get to the twin. No, you didn't, because there are no new updates. You pop at me again. Okay. Sorry. Now, not all contracts are drafted well. Sometimes you will see an agreement that's just poorly written. I mentioned that before. There's some strategic reasons. Sometimes it's because the terms are non-negotiable. And if they're non-negotiable, why bother letting people see them? Why bother letting people edit them? It is a particular frustration often when you're in practice. Oh, come on. Thank you. It's a particular frustration that sometimes you will ask for a copy of the agreement from the other side, and what you will get will be a PDF. If someone sends you a PDF of the agreement, what's the message that they are telling you? Right. Is it true? Functionally, no. PDFs can't, maybe scanned in, maybe character recognized, but it's an extra step. It's telling you, no, we don't want you to edit it. This is the contract. But at the same time, I'm here to tell you, don't assume that's going to be the case. Don't assume that even if your client is a very small company or an inventor dealing with a very large company, there's no opportunity to negotiate. You just may have limits on what you will be able to negotiate. So, if we're talking about a license agreement, once we list the parties, and what's the most important thing about, or what is a very important part of listing parties to an agreement? What do you have to be very careful about when you list parties to an agreement?
You list the correct entity.
Yep. And again, why is it important that you list the correct entity? Right, and similarly, you want to make sure for your own, you know, for your client that you've got the correct entity. Sometimes your client doesn't know. It's one of those things you really need to check. Sometimes when you say your client, it's kind of shorthand because, of course, the client is the entity if you're talking about a business. It's an inventor, fine, an individual, but your client, the person you deal with at the client may not exactly know the correct legal name of the entity. May, you know, it may have nothing to do with the trademark. There may be a doing business as certificate or something. So you want to make sure you check that and you check it on the other end as well. So right up at the top, you're going to have often the party names. You may say license agreement. Can be written in a number of different forms. Sometimes it will say dated as of. What does dated as of mean?
What is synonymous with the effective date of the agreement?
Which means what?
The date that the parties enter into the start date of the contractual obligation.
What's another way that the start date of an agreement may be indicated in a contract?
Or effective
date. Right. So the date that it is signed by both parties may be the time that the maybe the date of the agreement's commencement. But it's certainly possible and permissible to indicate some other date prior to or going forward. And why would you want to do that? Why would you want to particularly date it, let's say, March 15th, dated as of March 15th? What if it's not signed till March 18th? Does that change anything? It doesn't. And why you would do that may be because the clients are already working together, the parties are already working together, and it may take some time just to put the signatures on and get it back, but you want to be able to say, okay, if we're exercising our rights, they go back to the date of the agreement. So you want to, when you're drafting, you want to think about that. When must this agreement go into effect? For my purposes or for the purposes of the other side or for the purposes of the deal. Maybe there's something else that depends on this one getting signed and these rights getting licensed. In which case, you better be sure that these rights get licensed as of a date before the other one goes into effect. Otherwise, you're in breach. Because if you represent in the second one, we have these rights, but it turns out that the first one wasn't executed as of a date prior to that, you have some problems. You're also going to want to look at the as of date, because if there are termination rights or there's a term of the agreement, it probably dates back to the as of date. That could be hard enough to count if you'd use days versus months versus weeks. But you certainly want to get a good sense of when the agreement. Sometimes the agreement will be, as we've seen with some of your samples, sometimes it will be by, it will tell you right up front how you execute the agreement. When you have a shrink wrap license, when you have a license on software or some sort of product, where there not only isn't there a negotiation, but there's no signature. Why is it that when you have software or other kinds of licenses, some of which we saw last week, samples of them, why is it that the how to execute it goes right up front and not at the bottom? Why would they do that? Somebody who hasn't helped us out today? Remember those? Let's see if we have any examples of those. So this one doesn't. Hold on. Oh, here we go. Make that bigger. Right up front. Please read this software license agreement carefully before using the software. It's good advice. It's a contract. You should read it carefully. By using the Apple software, you are agreeing to be bound by the terms of this license. You do not agree to the terms of this license, do not use the software. If you do not agree to the terms of the license, you may return the Apple software to the place where you obtained it for a refund. If the Apple software was accessed electronically, click Disagree to Decline for Apple software included with your purchase of hardware. You must return the entire hardware software package in order to obtain a refund. Why is that right up front? Why isn't this in front of all contracts? If you agree to this, these terms, go sign it at the bottom. If you don't agree to it, don't sign it at the bottom and return the stuff to us. Why isn't that in every contract? Why is it in this kind of agreement?
With Apple and the user. You can't sit and have a conversation with them, talk and negotiate.
That's part of it. But even there, I mean, when you get a purchase order, it doesn't say that in business. When you get, there are a lot of business contracts that don't start out that way, even when they aren't negotiated. Why do you think? Okay, but there too. Do all business people read all of their contracts? Shouldn't they? Isn't it important? So there's a key difference, though.
Because once you use it, you're already bound. So if you're using the software, you're bound. You want to know that before using it.
Okay. What you're missing, though, or what hasn't come up yet, with what kind of licensee is Apple dealing here? Well,
somebody that doesn't deal in this, doesn't negotiate these kinds of contracts.
Maybe. I think there's a sort of broader term that isn't quite as insulting.
Directly with the end user, though, you're asking?
Well, the end user, and often end users are who? They're consumers. This is not a business-to-business license. When you're drafting for your client's purposes, you want to think about not only which entity is on the other side of the transaction, of the deal, of the license, but what kind of an entity is it? That has some implications for risk management. If it's a small company, you want to put in maybe more insurance requirements. If it's a large company, you want to be concerned that it's more likely to bring a lawsuit against your client because it has in-house lawyers and lawyers all over the place. And if it's a consumer, what are some of the concerns that a business might have setting up a contract with a consumer that are different from a business? Isn't that a good thing? They're not going to think about stuff? Isn't that an advantage to the business that the consumers aren't as sophisticated? Maybe, although there it simply say that we're not going to negotiate these because, but a lot of business deals are also not negotiated, and they may not be quite, some of these may be businesses. What is it about consumers?
Well, it's just like when you get that weed device, you just want to make sure they're not going to be public performance or just to explain things like that consumers usually don't realize.
Okay, so to a certain extent it's education. Well, customers are, right. I don't know if Apple makes more money from consumers versus businesses.
They're not sophisticated, so
you right.
Put everything up front.
Why? Because out of the goodness of your corporate heart?
It's a good faith measure to have them bound by the contract. It's good faith effort to have everything that's needed and tell them what they're getting.
That's a very optimistic view. What do you think? Well, that's what, right. So, what does it matter if the parties have unequal bargaining power? What does it matter if the parties have unequal sophistication? Who is likely to object?
The consumer. I think it falls back on the enforceability of the contract. So
it does, but why?
Like the more steps you put, I remember from contract and shrink wraps in particular, the more steps the company puts to you accepting the
all right, so that's a different issue of enforceability. That's an effort to try to demonstrate that someone had to have read it, right? Had to have done something affirmative, and that's important.
The more clear and upfront it is, the less the consumer can say that they didn't understand the term,
yep.
And they didn't understand.
Yep, say to whom?
To Apple.
Apple's going to say, you're bound by it. Say to whom?
To the court.
To the court. Consumer protection comes into the fore here. Courts will give more protection to consumers than to business people. They will be more skeptical of hiding, for example, when particularly in the shrink wrap license, when companies have put a mandatory arbitration provision deep within the agreement for consumers, courts have thrown those out because that's the sort of thing that needs to be negotiated. And you can't assume the consumer read it and thought about it and negotiated it. When these were first conceived, they were in the box. And when you opened up the box, you didn't get a secret toy surprise. You got a piece of paper that said, congratulations, by opening this box, you have agreed to the license agreement. And at some point, consumers challenged that, and the court said, hey, that's not fair. You can't expect them to know that they are licensing this before they open the box, that they're binding themselves to something. That's why license agreements are now on the outside of the box. That's why they're presented before the download. But understand, it isn't out of the goodness of Apple's heart. I'm not criticizing Apple's corporate benevolence, but They're doing this because they want to be more, you can't be certain, but more secure about enforceability. And one of the issues with enforceability is, will it be seen as a contract of adhesion? Will it be seen as a process that was unfair to the other side? When the other side are consumers, more protections are imposed. So some of what you see here, right, it starts out kind of plain languagey stuff, and then it goes into legally language. There's such a difference in tone. You're right, look at this. Hear my voice. Remote access of copyrighted music is only provided for lawful personal use or otherwise legally permitted. If you are uncertain about your right to copy or permit access to any material, you should contact your legal advisor. That's a nice sort of public service announcement. And then it goes into listen to the change in tone. The software documentation, any fonts accompanying this license, whether on disk, in read-only memory, any other media, or in any other form, collectively the Apple software, are licensed not sold to you by Apple Inc. for use only under the terms of this license, and Apple reserves all rights not expressly granted to you. The rights granted herein, once you see herein, you know it's not written for consumers. Sorry. Are limited to Apple's and its licensors' intellectual property rights in the Apple software and do not include any other patents or intellectual property rights. Right? So, major change in tone. So let's see how this contract is organized. Well, we sort of have Apple Inc., okay? Sort of you, doesn't even define you, but it's kind of conversational. It's a license, that tells you right up front. And because it's a shrink wrap type consumer license, it tells you how you're entering into it or not entering into it. Then what? Starts out with essentially the license terms. Tells you what is being licensed, what isn't. Tells you how you may use it, permitted license uses and restrictions. And in case you were wondering, iTunes is not intended for use in the operation of nuclear facilities, aircraft navigation or communication systems, air traffic control systems, life support machines, or other equipment in which the failure of the Apple software could lead to death, personal injury, or severe physical or environmental damage. I'm so shocked. Here's where you start saying, this was probably not drafted only for iTunes. That Malaysian airliner, they were running it on iTunes, but they hadn't updated it, so, you know, it was a bad thing. Life support machines. iTunes. Transfer. So first we have how to use it. Then we have rights to transfer. You may not rent, lend, lease, lend, redistribute, or sublicense the Apple software. You may, however, make a one-time permanent transfer right, transfer of all your license rights to the Apple software to another party, provided that A, the transfer must include all of the Apple software, including all of its component parts, original media, printed materials, and this license. You do not retain any copies of the Apple software, full or partial, including copies stored on a computer or other storage device, and the party receiving the Apple software reads and agrees to accept the terms and conditions of this license. What are they talking about here? When would the licensee make a one-time permanent transfer of his or her rights in the Apple software? Or you sell the old one, right? For sale, iTunes. I don't know what you'd get for it. For sale, Mac with iTunes on it, or Windows PC with iTunes on it. You buy my computer, you get the software on it. I don't have the software anymore. I'm not allowed to keep it. Oh, and by the way, as, you know, Craigslist person, I'd like you to read and agree to the license agreement from Apple, please. And all these other license agreements, like, probably not going to happen. But they at least... Now, sometimes other things come into license agreements that aren't really about the licensed material, per se. Look at what paragraph 4 says. You guys read this? Look what paragraph 4 is all about. They're allowed to watch you. They're allowed to make sure you're using the proper license. Apple may use this information as long as it is in a form that does not personally identify you to improve our products or to provide services or technologies to you. Not sure how it is able to provide things to me if they don't know who I am, but that's a privacy provision in the middle of a license agreement. Okay, it tells you about the iTunes store, what you're using it for. Now we have the terms of iTunes. The services. So it's not just a license agreement. It's also a services agreement. There's no rule that says a contract may only be one thing. As I think I mentioned to you, non-disclosure provisions are a useful thing to put in almost any business agreement. Here, we have services. What's interesting about this, though, is this is not the only place where you're going to get the terms of service. In fact, it says so. This software enables access to Apple's iTunes Store, which offers downloads of music for sale and other services, collectively and individually, services. Use of the services requires internet access, and use of certain services requires you to accept additional terms of service, which will be presented to you before you can use such services. By using this software in connection with an iTunes Store's account, you agree to the latest iTunes Store terms of service, which you may access and review from the homepage of the iTunes Store. And it wouldn't be surprising if it ended there. Hey, if you're using this, you're going to be using something else, and that something else has terms, and you should probably go look at them. But then, it goes on with more services stuff. Can you think of any problems or challenges or risks in putting terms related to services in this license agreement? When we also are told that there are terms related to the services attached to the actual services. What if they have conflicting provisions? And not only what if they have conflicting provisions now, but what if later on they have conflicting provisions? Strategically, and I don't mean in the strategy of negotiating, but from a pure risk management perspective, whenever you're dealing with the same thing in two different places, at least two different places, you run the risk that they will become inconsistent. And if they are inconsistent, and that inconsistency becomes a cause of action, you may have both of them thrown out. Because with which one does the consumer comply? It's a real risk. It's a risk whenever you're dealing with something in more than one place. It's even a risk if you're doing an amendment to an agreement or a rider. Recently, I had a client who was presented with a truly insufficient software license agreement from the licensor. There was a lot of custom development work, there were some support services, and what the client was given was almost a shrink wrap license. It just didn't deal with it. And so we had that discussion with the client, given the business relationship, given what you think is on the other side. Is there a lawyer? Is there not? What do you want us to do? And ultimately the client said, it was actually a very good client, very sharp client, had already spotted the major problems, which is good because then you don't have to convince the client that you really need to do some work. Client got it. So what do we do? Client said, write something. You know, we need this. It doesn't say it. Write something. But then we thought about the strategy, and it was suggested to me by the lawyer with whom I was working. It was a good strategy, was make it a rider. Meaning, make it essentially, this is also part of the agreement. So you're not rewriting the entire agreement. You're essentially writing a second agreement saying, this is also part of this. But it raises the obvious challenge. Not only were we adding things, but we were changing things. What do you do? So we made sure that right up front, this is the rider to this agreement. It's effective as of when the other agreement is effective. Good. So there's no gap in coverage, so to speak. But then we said, to the extent that there is any conflict between the terms of the rider and the term and any of the terms of the original agreement, the terms of the rider control. Anytime you are doing a modification, an addition, maybe there's a master contract and then you're doing what they're called statements of work. So you have the master contract sets up the relationship between the service provider and the customer. But there may be lots of small projects. Often what happens is you have a master agreement and then you have a rider or an amendment or some statement of work. It is crucial, crucial, when you are drafting or reviewing the statement of work, that somewhere in there it says, if there are any conflicts between what's here and what we did before, what's here is the what we want to do. Because you can't be sure. You can't get everything. But you want to make sure that the newer version is more complete. So one of the things you could do here in this situation, if your client says, look, we don't know they're going to read the terms of service, and we want to make sure that there are certain important things that are part of this. So one of the things you can do, though, is say, one place or the other, and maybe they did, we'd have to look. Any conflict between these terms and any other statement of the terms, this version controls. So if the website gets updated and this doesn't, or this gets updated and the website doesn't, one of them should say, this is the one we look to. If we're not sure which is newest, most correct, this one is. Without that, though, putting this in place or putting privacy stuff in a terms of service on a website, you really do run the risk that you're going to forget or double draft and have to work your way around that conflict that you didn't intend to be. Okay, so let's go on. So we see now what's being licensed, how it's maybe used, how it isn't, some other stuff. Term? That is a very silly sentence. I'm sorry. This license is effective until terminated. This person is dead, is alive until he's dead. This light is on until it's off. I'm not sure what that adds. Anybody have a view on that that I'm just missing because my head is stuffed with whatever it's stuffed with? It just doesn't, this license is effective until terminated. Well, yes. It's not capitalized. Your rights under this license will terminate automatically without notice from Apple if you fail to comply with any terms of this license. Upon the termination of this license, you shall cease all use of the Apple software and destroy all copies, full or partial, of the Apple software. So,
can the user terminate it, right?
By transferring to somebody else, as long as the user owns. Yeah, I think you're right. The user may. Let's see.
It doesn't state there how the user can terminate unless if they stop complying with the contract, it's terminated.
Right. You can terminate by breaching, but that's not a really good way to do it.
Just with that termination
except you don't get to end it. You have no protection here. You have no rights. You have obligations.
I can end my iTunes use.
Do you still have iTunes on your computer?
If you uninstalled everything, couldn't that be this license is effective until terminated, meaning by me, the user, or the...
But it doesn't say that. If you want to say, if you wish to terminate the agreement, uninstall. It doesn't say that. It doesn't even say that here. It's a transfer of your license rights. You are, on a practical level, you are correct. If that's your only Apple software, and you uninstall it, but you're not free of your obligations here. You're not free of your obligations not to copy it, not to modify it, not to do anything else. All of those obligations remain true unless Apple decides to terminate or it terminates because of your breach.
They may not have included the uninstallation provision because I think even if you uninstall it, your account is not going to stay.
But then that's not a license. Yeah, that's probably one reason, which is you've got a multifaceted license relationship with Apple, including licenses and rights to use services and the like. There may be a more prosaic, just a more practical reason why it's not here. They don't want to remind you that you can uninstall it. They don't want you to stop using iTunes. But the odd thing about this termination provision, well, I was going to say that basically it's self-enforced. If you breach it, stand in the corner and uninstall everything, except the stand in the corner part. But of course, we know that's not the only enforcement mechanism, because right up here it does tell us, right? That Apple is reserving the right to monitor your system to verify compliance with the terms of this license. So notwithstanding their particular commercial, Apple is Big Brother and it is watching you. I always thought that commercial reminded me of Steve Jobs at Apple Worldwide Developer Conferences, but that's another story. Now, we talked about warranties. And when you're in a business-to-business context, both parties will likely seek some promises. Right, that you have the right to enter into the contract, nothing violates any other contract, you own the rights that you're licensing, all of those things. Well, here, Apple is the licensor, right? So if we followed that pattern, you would see those things, including some sort of an IP warranty. Apple Inc. has all rights necessary to grant this license to you. Do you see that? What is the warranty that you get? There's really only one. No, it doesn't say that. In fact, it specifically doesn't say that. It tells you, right? It's provided as is, with all faults, and without warranty of any kind, including but not limited to the implied warranties of and or conditions of merchantability, that means it's worthy of sale to you, satisfactory quality of fitness for a particular purpose, of accuracy, of quiet enjoyment, and non-infringement of third-party rights. Apple does not warrant your enjoyment, does not warrant the functions will meet your requirements, that it will be uninterrupted or error-free, defects will be corrected. Apple doesn't warrant anything except what? No, it doesn't. What does 7 give you? 7 does not give you anything about the intellectual property.
But it says free from defect.
Ah, no, it doesn't. Well, it does. I'm not saying you're reading incorrectly. What does it say will be free from defect?
The disc or the media or whatever it is.
The disc.
But whatever it comes on.
Right.
If
you get a DVD from Apple, the DVD won't be cracked. It won't be scratched in a way that makes it unusable. It won't be melted. And if it is, within the first 90 days, as long as you're not the one who has scratched it or melted it or cracked it, they'll replace it for you. The medium. The disc. Now, of course, if you're downloading, you don't even get that. That's it. That is it. Now you can imagine, as consumers, by the way, this is fairly standard. I'm not picking on Apple. But if you are counseling software developers, especially those working with consumers, you're going to want to have some version of this because software is not perfect. It is never error-free. It is never guaranteed to meet requirements on a universal consumer basis. If it's custom software development, then you're going to be negotiating these provisions much differently. But if you're talking about off the shelf, think of it like buying a book. When you go to a bookstore, they still have bookstores, right? One or two somewhere. If you go to a bookstore, or the virtual equivalent thereof, and you purchase a book, of course, you're not purchasing intellectual property there either. You are purchasing, at most, a pile of paper that contains intellectual property to which you have a license. It doesn't say that, but that's what a book is as much as a disc is, right? You are licensed, implied license, to read and shelve, but not make copies of and not distribute or publicly perform the copyrighted material contained in this sheaf of papers with glue and stitching and stuff. Are you warranted to enjoy the book? Is there a promise that you're going to like it? But if there are 12 pages missing, you could probably return it. Now, the store, the retailer may say, we'll take the risk because we've negotiated some sort of return rights with our wholesaler. You know, but we're not going to promise you like it. We're just going to allow you to get a refund for a certain amount of time because it's good customer service to allow us to do that. And if you abuse it, talk to, oh, I don't know, stores that sell bridesmaid dresses and the like, or cocktailware or other sorts of things that people might want to use once and then, right, return because they only have one need for it, get a full refund. They tend to tighten up their return policies because they are abused. But that's a choice that they are making, separate from a product warranty. Books aren't warrantied for enjoyment, for being error-free, and neither is software. And software is even tetchier. They're not warranting much of anything. Now, there's an interesting, and we're going to go back over these provisions in greater detail. So I just want to start with the overview, sort of the pieces. And then maybe next class we're going to look at a business-to-business license to see the differences. Yeah. Sure they are. Until and unless Apple terminates the license. No, would you be permitted to do it if they didn't license it? If there were no license prohibitions, would you be permitted to make unlimited copies and sell and distribute and do all those other things? Is it the agreement that prohibits that? The copyright does. If anything, the agreement grants you certain things that otherwise wouldn't be automatic under Apple's copyright. What it does as well, though, is set up contractual remedies. Right? That's why even when people may say that you're allowed to jailbreak an Apple device or root an Android device, use software, use methodologies to get outside of the use restrictions, the modification restrictions. Even when the law permits you under copyright, it's still entirely possible that any service warranty, if there is one, on the device will be revoked as a breach of contract. So they put it in place. Even if they don't revoke it, right? If they would revoke it, you still don't have it. You have no rights to it. But if they revoke it, then they may also lose some of the contractual remedies. It's not really relevant here. People don't think about terminating iTunes licenses. Apple might want to have the right to do it, but by and large, there's no ongoing cost. The only reason I can see, sort of off the top of my head, that someone might want to actually terminate the license goes back to the privacy issue. Unless you terminate this contract, Apple is retaining the rights to monitor you. Even if you stop using iTunes. And so I can see that someone who was particularly concerned about these things might want to figure out a way to affirmatively terminate the agreement. But short of that, it just keeps going. So I just wanted to get back to a sort of oddness that comes out of the law. Where might we get implied warranties, and I'll help you out, for the sale of goods? Where might there be legal obligations regarding the sale of goods outside of the copyright law? The UCC, Article 2, right? Those of you who are thinking about the bar exam have probably come a little familiar with it. If you're taking sales, you're probably more intimately familiar with it. But that is, and I think all, I'm not sure about Louisiana, but just about every other state anyway, right? There is this uniform commercial code. And what the UCC does is it sets up the default rules. unless the parties agree otherwise, here is what state law says about what needs to happen with the sale of goods. And some of those things include implied warranties. Implied meaning if you don't say exclude them, they're there because of the UCC. Does the UCC apply to iTunes? Or any software? Is it? How does the UCC define? They call it a service. Hold on a second. Okay, here's a UCC, right? I don't know which one. This is an old version. Oh, wait, let's go back to the current version. Go back. Go up. Okay. Here. Okay, definitions. Definitions, goods. Meaning all things, including specially manufactured goods which are movable at the time of identification to the contract for sale, other than the money in which the price is to be paid, investment securities, and things in action. Is software movable? What does movable mean? No, it doesn't. It means that you can pick it up. Maybe you need a forklift. But it can, it's not real property. Real property, absent a rather large seismic event, doesn't move. Goods move. Does software move? It doesn't. It doesn't. It is intellectual property. Trademarks don't move either. Patents don't move. So what makes this interesting is that while we draft, aren't you glad that you're all the way over there? Seriously. We draft, and certainly Apple drafts, and I draft, and you will draft, as if the UCC applies here, because we make a point of excluding implied warranties of merchantability and fitness for a particular purpose, which are very UCC-ish things. There was an effort to deal with this. Yeah. The disk is a good.
Right.
The medium is a good. The software is not. You're not buying software. We just saw that, right? What's the warranty on? What are they actually selling you that has a goods type warranty? The disk. The plastic thing. That's it. The device. The Mac on which iTunes is preloaded, that's goods. Those are goods, Macs. And they are subject to whatever UCC remedies plus the terms of sale and all those things. But software isn't a license. Now, this is not a new idea. Software doesn't fit well into goods because it's intellectual property. And because it's supported and updated and things that goods generally aren't, but it's sold, at least the media on which it's contained, sold in the market. And people buy it. And they don't think about, especially when there were computer stores, yes, they existed, with software you could buy. You could still go to Staples and buy a box with a disc in it. So people say, well, why don't we have a UCC for software? let's come up with a UCC for software. And they did. The Uniform Computer Information Transactions Act, UCITA. It was drafted from 1996 to 1999. I remember, whom did I meet? I met somebody who ended up being a longtime professional friend at an information session that InfoWorld was running with one of the NIMRs on this issue, proposed uniform code for software, back mid-90s. So is the UCITA in New York? No. It doesn't really show up anywhere. Because nobody wanted it. Nobody involved in the industry wanted it. The definitions were just so out there, they couldn't quite, you know, how do you determine whether software is error-free for the purposes of UCITA? UCITA, it says here, generally approves the validity of software licenses as long as the user is given an opportunity to return the goods at the seller's expense if the license terms are found objectionable. It has not really been put into play. So, worth knowing it's there, but it didn't really happen. So instead, we act as if the UCC applies, and then we exclude all of it. That's what you see here. Right? Implied warranties, right? Hereby disclaim all warranties and conditions with respect to the Apple software and services, either express, implied, or statutory, including but not limited to the implied warranties and or conditions of merchantability, satisfactory quality, of fitness of particular purpose, of accuracy, of quiet enjoyment, and non-infringement of third-party rights. You have no rights unless there is a particular statute that says you do, in which case Apple has no ability to carve that out. It says here, some jurisdictions do not allow the exclusion of implied warranties or limitations on applicable statutory rights of a consumer, so the above exclusion and limitations may not apply to you. Isn't that comforting? So, what promises are we making? None. Really none. None whatsoever, none at all, none, no how, no way, no sir, unless we're required to by law. But otherwise, none. And we put it in big letters in theory to make it easier to read, but of course, it isn't. And what happens if you're damaged? What happens if you're hurt? What happens if, in fact, you disregard the requirement, the restrictions, and you run your life-saving device on iTunes, or your air traffic control system, or your nuclear reactor, or whatever? To the extent not prohibited by law, in no event shall Apple be liable for personal injury or any incidental, special, indirect, or consequential damages whatsoever. We're going to go over that in a little greater detail when we look at the exclusion of the limitation on liability provisions, including without limitation, damages for loss of profits, loss of data, business interruption, other commercial damages or losses arising out of or related to your use or inability to use the Apple software or services, however caused, regardless of the theory, and even if Apple has been advised of the possibility of such damages. In no event shall Apple's total liability to you for all damages, other than as may be required by applicable law in cases involving personal injury, exceed the amount of $50. The foregoing limitations will apply even if the above stated remedy fails of its essential purpose. So if Apple, what this says, although it's not necessarily true, because the law would kind of have something to say about it, if Apple chose intentionally to set out to destroy your life, It chose you as its victim. It determined who you were, which of your its products you were using, and pushed out to your computer alone a version of iTunes that was designed to ruin your life, to break up with your boyfriend or girlfriend using your name, to take all of your money and donate it to your least favorite political party, to do all of those things. As long as the computer didn't blow up in your face, by the terms of this agreement, how much are you able to recover legally from Apple for ruining your life, breaking up with your significant other on your behalf, moving all your money to your least favorite charity, poisoning your pet, whatever it is? I shouldn't say poisoning your pet because that's personal injury. How much? Big $50. Go to town. But they don't want you in town because your computer has messed up your life. Maliciousness probably cannot be excluded. Malice, maybe not even gross negligence. But you see the effort here. Again, as far as the law allows them, they are going to step away from any responsibility. So when we say Apple is doing this out of the goodness of their heart, why do they start at the beginning with the license terms? Because they care about the consumer? It doesn't seem to carry through with all this other stuff. Oh, the export control stuff, government end users, we looked at some of that, we'll come back to this. Controlling law. Professor Graves would be very unhappy because the United Nations Conventions on Contract for the International Sale of Goods is expressly excluded. This is the complete agreement, it says here. Then you have some third-party licensing, because that's interesting, because Apple incorporates third-party software into iTunes. The Grace Notes CD database, which is how when you put a disc in your machine to import it into iTunes, it fills in all the track names and the album name. There's the CD database that recognizes, that's one of the things that Apple does when it says it's going to take data from your computer. It looks at the CD, and based on the data on it, they'll query this database. They'll say, oh, that looks like this disc. Sometimes there'll be multiple entries because people have typed it in themselves. And you go, is it this disc or this disc? That's a third-party software. Apple is a licensee, giving you a sub-license. And so here are the terms of that sub-license passed through from Gracenote. Kerbango. I don't know what Kerbango is, but it's apparently in iTunes also. Three comes to Kerbango Tuning Service. More exclusions. Okay. So this is back in 2007. Okay. So, again, structure. Most important stuff up front, maybe. Most important sort of substance of what's being licensed, by whom, to whom, for what purpose. Right up front-ish. In the middle, promises, exclusions on promises, warranties, exclusions on warranties. And towards the end, the more general. So licenses are specific to license agreements. Warranties, limitations on liability, sales contracts, license contracts, that sort of thing, services agreements. And then towards the end, general, miscellaneous, you'll have a lot of different provisions. You'll have the choice of law, which country or which state's laws apply. In the United States, most states are fairly standardized when it comes to contract law. California may have some more consumer-friendly things, different states, but that's one thing. Forum, and we'll come back to forum, where the suit is held, entirely separable from the choice of law. You'll often have a force majeure provision, dun, 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 which means that things out of our control we're not responsible for. You will have whether or not the contract may be assigned. May one party or the other hand off its rights or its obligations to somebody else, and under what circumstances? May the contract be modified? If so, by whom? What's required? Notices. What if something needs notice under the contract? How does it happen? In what format? To whom does it get sent? When is it applicable? What pieces are there? Are there exhibits to the contract? Are there riders? They have to be incorporated by reference. This contract, this thing, including its exhibits, is the contract. There's nothing else. And then if it's a signed contract, you'll have the signatures near the bottom. Then you might have exhibits and riders. Most license agreements that you read, that you draft, that you review will fit that general structure because it's what makes sense. And a lot of times you will see similar provisions because certain patterns have developed over the course of use, which things are generally in license agreements and which aren't. So this is a consumer license, not negotiated, not remotely equal bargaining power, has been modified over the years in part because of challenges to it, like this. The license is on the outside, is presented first instead of being on the inside. By the time you see it, you've already, in theory, agreed to it. Some sub-licensing things. Dealing with the process, dealing with the challenge that it's harder for Apple, for the licensor, to demonstrate, to prove that the licensee actually read and agreed to it. And we'll talk as we get into more drafting what you want to do and when you want to add to the requirements of execution to have a more specific identified signatory as opposed to this, where really they don't care who you are specifically. The stakes are fairly low, the restrictions are fairly high, the cost. You're not paying them anything, but they get a lot of revenue from you, so they're not doing a lot here to care about who you are. All right? So this, let's do the same kind of analysis in our next class on a business-to-business to see what are the similarities are, what the differences are. If you want to look at this again, if you want to look at some of the others, they're all on the TWEN page. Questions? Have a good night.